Chapter 16. The Death Flash and the Life Flash. In the previous chapter, we looked at the role that plasma has inside the body, forming and regulating it and maintaining health. In this chapter, we will look at it in relation to death. It has been said that at the moment of death, a flash of light is emitted by the body. There are many reports of this. It applies to all living organisms, not only to people. The evidence concerning this flash of light is extensive, and the speculations concerning it have entered into works of fiction and film. This is one of the most important details about the relationship between the physical body and any animating plasma body that may coexist with it. It is what has come to be known as the death flash. In case there are misunderstandings, I should point out that apart from the exceptions described in a moment, the only spontaneously emitted light from our bodies consists of biophotons, as was discussed in Chapter 15. They cannot be seen by the eye because they are what is called ultra-weak and low intensity. It only became possible to detect them at all after the laboratory devices known as photomultipliers were invented in the 1950s. Let us find out more about the death flash, however, because although it cannot be seen by the unaided eye either, apparently it is followed by a faint mist that is visible to the naked eye, but only for an instant, and you have to be looking intently at where it is about to happen just when it does. The Polish biophoton researcher, the late Professor Janusz Sławiński, 1936-2016, published a summary of many of the occurrences of the death flash, technically known as necrotic, from nekros, the ancient Greek word for a dying person or human corpse, necrotic photon emission, with his extensive comments in 1987. In it he says, quote, "All living organisms emit low-intensity light. At the time of death, that radiation is 10 to 10,000 times stronger than that emitted under normal conditions. This death flash is independent of the cause of death and reflects in intensity and duration the rate of dying. The vision of intense light reported in near-death experiences may be related to this death flash, which may hold an immense amount of information. The electromagnetic field produced by necrotic radiation, containing energy, internal structure, and information, may permit the continuation of consciousness beyond the death of the body." Unquote. This is clearly very important information. Considering how terrified most people are of dying, you would think that this information would be more widely circulated, if only to assuage people's anxieties. But strangely, few people have heard about it. This is puzzling to me. I think it must be because we live in a world today where intellectuals, mainstream social opinion formers, and mass media all subscribe to a rigidly materialistic view of life, and are intolerant of anyone who challenges this arid position in even the slightest way. The first time I came across the idea of a death flash was in a work of fiction. In his 1931 novella, The Weigher of Souls, André Malraux adopts his own persona as the first-person narrator. He says he has been a French liaison officer with the British, and that the British officer with whom he shared a tent was a medic named Dr. H.B. James. This is how the strange adventure begins, for the narrator comes to London after 7 years of not having seen Dr. James and decides to look him up. The action is thus set in London in 1925, and the novella is consciously written in the style of an Edwardian mystery or science fiction story, heavily influenced by Conan Doyle and H.G. Wells. The reader half expects Sherlock Holmes to appear, or a time machine to be mentioned. But Mawa has a much more subtle tale to tell than it first appears. Dr. James is working at St. Barnaby's Hospital, a very Victorian establishment on the south bank of the Thames. London is described in the best Conan Doyle tradition as covered with fog. Quote, "Whilst we had been dining, a thick fog had come down over the streets. The gleaming headlights of invisible cars planted it with rings of red and white light. Ludgate Circus was a landscape of nightmare. James bade me take his arm and guided me towards a bus. The bus crossed the river in the midst of a veritable bank of yellow cotton wool. Factory fires on that baleful shore gleamed vast and pale through the flocculent gloom. The lights of the hospital shone feebly in the enveloping cloud. My companion's nervous state seemed to be one of violent overexcitement." Unquote. James has become such a haunted and distracted person, so different from the narrator's jolly wartime friend, because he is engaged in forbidden experiments, which he carries out in the morgue of the hospital at great risk of being discovered. He has discovered that something strange happens at death, and he wants to investigate it. He says he got the idea from experiments carried out by Sir William Crookes, one of Victorian Britain's most distinguished scientists, who later in life developed an interest in spiritualism. This was discussed earlier in Chapter 3. James explains, quote, "I once read an account in a medical paper during the war of an experiment made by a certain Dr. Crookes. He described how he had weighed the corpses of animals and observed that after a period approximately regular in a given species, there was an abrupt drop in weight. In a man, he reckoned this fall as averaging 1/1700 of a milligram, from which he concluded that a soul does exist and that it weighs 1/1700 of a milligram. Last year, as circumstances in hospital routine placed corpses at my disposal, it occurred to me to verify the facts registered by Crookes, and with some surprise, I discovered he had told the truth. Only he had stopped the experiment too soon. In man, the normal curve of evaporation is almost always interrupted, not once, but three times, by sudden falls. The first, which you have observed tonight, takes place about 1 hour and 35 minutes after death, and is between 15 and 19/20 of a milligram. The second and third follow the first at intervals of 20 minutes and 1 hour, respectively. Regarding the results of the experiment, no doubt is possible. Let me add that I have repeated them with animals, whence the rats, which intrigued you. And there, too, Crookes' results are correct. There is always a sharp drop, but its extent is very much less than in man. Such are the facts. The interpretation, of course, admits of argument." His pipe had gone out. He relit it and looked at me. I was careful to say nothing. He continued, "At this stage, this is what I put forward. It seems to me possible to suggest not that the soul weighs 1/1700 of a milligram, but that every living creature is animated by a certain form of energy, still unknown, which leaves the body after death. That all energy possesses mass is something admitted by the post-Einstein physicists. You know that light can be weighed, and that theoretically light could be compressed in a receptacle. Well, why not vital energy likewise?" End of the quote. James decides that he wants to catch the mist that rises from a person who has just died in a glass receptacle. This is what he believes has the slight weight. And as a scientist friend of the narrator says, "Why shouldn't there be psychons as there are electrons?" James wants to capture the evanescent psychic substance of a dying person and keep it captive to study it. He makes it visible by ultraviolet light in an otherwise dark room. He succeeds in capturing the spirit of a dead rat in a glass bell jar. The narrator sees it in the dark as a faint glow, about the size of a nut, but more elongated. Quote, going closer, I saw that the interior of this luminous kernel contained darker currents revolving extremely slowly. The whole thing reminded one of the appearance of certain photographs of celestial nebulae. Close quote. Remember the whirling plasmoids of Bostick that we encountered earlier, which he compared to galaxies? The story gets weirder and weirder. At last, the narrator is present at the death of a human being, and James has his glass bell jar ready. Marois says, quote, I saw a faint blue mist appearing. At first it seemed shapeless and as if diffused. Then the vapor became condensed in a milky mass about 4 inches long, the base of which was horizontal, with its rounded top following the curve of the globe. Currents of lighter and darker color were visible in it, until they formed an object of well-defined outline, a ball of light. Unquote. I do not wish to spoil the enjoyment of anyone reading the novella by saying what happens as the story progresses, but it does become increasingly bizarre. Subsequent to the appearance of this novella, and possibly because of it, a legend was born that each of us has a soul that weighs 21 grams. Although largely unknown in the English-speaking world, there were some French intellectuals who became interested in the weight of the human soul. One of these was Wilfrid René Chataigne, who had been influenced in his thinking about the soul by studying the Siberian shamans, about whom he published a book in 1947, and who wrote in a paper published in 1986, quote, various investigations established the weight escaping at the moment of passing to between 60 and 70 grams. The quantity of spirit is without mass, and consequently the weight of a spiritual being is almost negligible. Close quote. Much better known than any experiments by Sir William Crookes were those carried out in America by Duncan MacDougall, 1866 to 1920, in 1901. He weighed 6 dying human patients, 5 male and 1 female. He calculated the weight of the human soul at between 6 and 8 ounces. He also tried to photograph the escaping human soul from dying persons. But as we now know, if one is looking for a light flash, a biophoton flash, it is too faint for the human eye, or any normal camera, to detect, even though it may be, as Swarovski discovered, as much as 10,000 times stronger than a biophoton is normally. But even that remains ultra-weak, as all biophoton emissions are. One presumes that the faintly visible mist follows the ultra-weak death flash and escapes the body by floating upwards. The death flash presumably heralds the commencement of the process of death, and the mist completes it. By 1907, MacDougall had refined his estimate of the weight of the soul to 21 grams, which is about 3/4 of an ounce, which is where that value originated. This was the source of the title of a 2003 film starring Sean Penn, 21 Grams, which popularized the notion that the human soul has a tiny mass. I might mention in passing also that the ancient Egyptians depicted the weighing of the human soul in a balance against a feather, representing truth, and they maintained that if the soul were heavier than that feather, it would be annihilated. Presumably at 21 grams, it would just squeak through. Inevitably, most descriptions of a faint mist leaving the body of a dying person come from relatives or friends who have been sitting near a dying person, often in hospital. Here is a typical example of such a story, recounted by a woman who lay in one bed of a double bed room in a hospital, of what she saw happen to the older woman in the other bed about midnight. She related this to her daughter the next day, who wrote it down. Quote, late one night, Shortly after 12 o'clock, my mother lay awake. Suddenly, she told me, she felt her attention drawn to Mrs. Melberger's bed. As she watched, she saw a white mist arise from her head. It hovered for a few seconds, then slowly began spiraling, and floated away from the woman and out through the closed door of the room. Unquote. The woman then fell asleep, and when she woke up in the morning, the bed opposite her was empty, and the nurse told her that Mrs. Melberger had died a little after midnight. Obviously, it is impossible to carry out laboratory experiments on dying people in order to look for mists, so it is difficult to imagine how this phenomenon can ever be scientifically proved, no matter how many accounts exist. It is easy to debunk such accounts if one has fixed ideas that no such thing can happen. It is equally easy to believe everything if one has fixed ideas that anything of that kind is possible. I have no personal experience of this. I only sat beside a dying person once, the author Rosamund Lehman, but I summoned a doctor and left before she actually departed a short while later. Incidentally, and ironically, she had a passionate belief in the survival of death and was a member of the Society for Psychical Research. It is because people essentially believe what they like when evidence is subjective that I have excluded my own subjective information from this book. In addition to the visual observations of a faint mist leaving the body at death, there have been other strange observations under more controlled conditions. In 1970, Ostrander and Schroeder, who interviewed many Soviet scientists, stated that some of the scientists had taken many photos of dying animals and plants using Kirlian photography and other techniques. One of the scientists involved in these studies was Professor Viktor Mikhailovich Inushin, who, as we have seen, knew the Kirlians when he was a child, and who originated the concept of bioplasma. Here's what Ostrander and Schroeder said. Quote, "In the course of their extensive research with the Kirlian process, the Soviets have many times photographed the moment of death. Little by little, as a plant's or animal's physical body dies, Russians saw sparks and flares of the bioplasmic body shooting out into space, swimming away and disappearing from sight. Gradually, there was no luminescence at all coming from the dead plant or animal. Meanwhile, biological field detectors at a distance continued to detect pulsating force fields from the now dead body. Is this energy coming from the dispersing bioplasmic body?" End of quote. Although this account refers only to studies of the deaths of animals and plants, I have found an account of studies of humans in a rare book published in English in Russia shortly after the fall of the Soviet Union by Dr. Konstantin G. Korotkov, then a young scientist who had only recently completed his PhD. He describes his studies with colleagues using something called the gas discharge visualization technique, which he abbreviates GDV, to study energies in living beings. The technique involves placing fingers on glass electrodes that are then supplied with a high voltage and high frequency pulse. The electric discharge around the finger produces light that is digitally photographed and sent to a computer, where special software does quantitative analysis of the numerous parameters. Korotkov tells us in his book, I have had to make a few grammatical improvements because the English was flawed, quote, "Does the life of the soul end with death? What should we expect beyond the threshold of this world? These problems, which have always beset mankind, are again making their appearance on the European intellectual horizon. Religions and esoteric knowledge have always taught that death is much more than merely a transformation of living material into dead material. Now that recollections of people who have experienced clinical death, NDEs, or near-death experiences are here referred to, are becoming accepted as real, The question of survival of some vital elements is entering the realms of science. Many of the physical-chemical processes occurring at the time of death are known. These changes proceed in linear fashion with the gradual process of destruction and decomposition. The gas discharge visualization technique, however, goes beyond the classical biochemical approach to reveal some aspects of energy and information in the living body. This being so, it became of great interest to find out how this changes after death. In this way, we might gain information of how the transition from the dying state to death takes place. The experiment was organized as follows. A special group of doctors and assistants took part in every experiment. The selected human body was transported to the experimental room and was placed in a definite position. The left hand was installed in a definite position on an electrode and was fixed by a special device that ensured a stationary position of the hand and the fingers during the experimental session. The discharge Kirlian photos of four fingers, excluding the thumb, of the left hand were taken every hour during the day and during the night. Then the photos were processed in controlled conditions, scanned to the computer, and from each image a set of parameters, area, average intensity, fractality, etc., was calculated. Then graphs of these parameters plotted against time were created. As a result of this process, we got for every experiment the graph curves of glow intensity changes in time during 3 to 6 days and were able to compare these curves, unquote. The results were numerous and are presented in the book in technical form with graphs. More than 60 scientific papers were also published in Russian over many years reporting these results. Here are the conclusions as briefly expressed in the book. Quote, on the basis of these results, we conclude that the energy information activity of a person does not go to zero at clinical death. In some cases, it continues to be present even as much as 4 days after death, a time when all biochemical processes characteristic of life will have ceased and been replaced with autolytic and putrefactive processes. It was particularly significant that the course of decline depended on the cause and nature of death. In some years, these experiments had been reproduced both in our laboratory, which was at the Federal Technical University of St. Petersburg, and in some others. The results were in principle the same. It seems then that traditional spiritual teachings are right in their insistence that something of a person survives after death. These results raise not only biological and practical questions, but also philosophical ones. Our common sense materialistic view of life and death needs some correction. End of quote. Since so many people who have had near-death experiences report that they floated upwards to the ceiling as soon as they left their physical bodies and looked down upon them from above, that would seem to tally with the rising mist escaping from the body. On the other hand, I have friends who came back to life after floating up to the ceiling. So does the mist get sucked back downwards again? Clearly, we are in speculative territory here. Swavinsky published a very technical article about the death flash, complete with 28 equations and 9 diagrams, in 2003 in the large volume of papers entitled Integrative Biophysics, Biophotonics. In this important paper, he puts forward in great detail a model that, quote, accounts at least partially for the experimentally determined properties of a stationary and necrotic death, photon emission, from an intact and irreversibly perturbed, meaning dying, organism, respectively. But where do biophotons come from, and where do photons of the necrotic radiation go to? Is there any kingdom of light beyond the stars, planets, plants, and animals? These questions challenge us to enrich our understanding of biophotons and the mystery of life and death. Light has always been intrinsically related to the creative power that gives birth to life. Indeed, the cell division, fertilization of an egg, and the death of the cell are accompanied by photon emission. Light is considered as the unitary purposive principle which engenders the universe. He does not say by whom, but he is presumably referring to some religious traditions, and possibly the views of some scientists, especially in light of what he says next about photosynthesis. And that has the nature of first cause. It is an ultimate source of energy on Earth, and a driving force of photosynthesis and other photobiological processes. Recent findings suggest that biophotons convey hidden information coded in the spatiotemporal parameters of the electromagnetic field, such as a degree of coherence. Therefore, biophoton emission might deliver important information about the onset and the end of life processes. If necrotic photon emission appears to be a universal phenomenon, announcing the end of biological life, then its measurements could be a new criterion of biological death. End of quote. This is an interesting suggestion that clinical death could be measured by this new means. It might avoid mistakes such as people being declared dead on the basis of their breathing having stopped or their hearts having stopped beating, and then nevertheless they suddenly return to life, occasionally after having been taken to the morgue as a corpse. Sometimes people can come back to life after an astonishing length of time. The novelist Franz Werfel was declared clinically dead in 1943, but then came back to life 45 minutes later and recounted an amazingly detailed near-death experience that occurred to him during that time. He died a second time, staying dead in 1945. This information is not publicly known. It was told to me by my friend Professor Adolf Klarman, who knew Werfel very well, was the editor of his works, and who looked after his widow until her death. Perhaps biophoton measurements would provide a new and foolproof method of determining genuine death. Many people reading about this will be unaware of the astonishing progress made in recent years in understanding aspects of light never previously suspected. Much of this research has been funded by governments and corporations rushing to perfect quantum computing, and some of it can help us understand how the processes involved in the death flash might work. To take one example, a team of scientists at Stanford University in California, as long ago as 2005, which in this field seems like the age of the dinosaurs, published a paper entitled Generation and Manipulation of Non-Classical Light Using Photonic Crystals. They are talking about cavities inside minute crystals capable of storing photons. At the head of this paper, they inform us, quote, "Photonic crystal cavities can localize light into nanoscale volumes, which are somewhere between a molecule and a virus, with high-quality factors. This permits a strong interaction between light and matter," unquote. This field is now referred to as nanophotonics because, obviously, it takes place at the nanoscale and is hence a branch of nanotechnology. These areas of science are certainly underreported. When considering a burst of light as weak as that of the death flash, we need to keep in mind that light can be stored inside one of these photonic crystals, also called a light crystal. These crystals exist at the upper end of the nanoscale, meaning they are about the size of viruses. In laboratories, light crystals have been fabricated in 1, 2, and 3 dimensions. One of the reasons why so much work has been done on this is because people wish to use them to construct optical computers, by which is meant computers that employ photons for the purposes of computation. Turning back to our main concerns, at the nanoscale, all organisms apparently contain countless light cavities, or nanovoids. If we have earlier been puzzling, therefore, about where the light would have come from that is released in the death flash, we have plenty of potential light cavities throughout the body to choose from. Maybe the pineal gland contains one or more, for instance, as it is known to have some unexplained light sensitivity aspects. The main point is that light storage happens all the time, so the release of a burst of light poses no real logistical difficulty. In other words, the storage of such a body of light would be entirely normal when the organism was alive, and its release at death could be automatic. I am speaking only in general terms, as not enough is known yet to be more specific. We don't necessarily need to know where a death flash comes from. The Polish scientist Barbara Kwirot published a paper in 1998 with the pertinent title, "Do We Always Need to Know Molecular Origin of Light Emitted by Living Systems?" In this paper she says, quote, "It is now commonly accepted that both the intensity and the spectrum of the ultra-weak luminescence depend strongly on the physiological state of the living systems, on their state of development, and on the actions of the external factors, especially those that can be considered the stress factors." And of course, the ultimate stress factor is death. Reports of mist arising from a dying person have been reported frequently over the years, and the subject has been mentioned in various scattered publications. But a good place to turn to for some collected evidence is the book Glimpses of Eternity by Raymond Moody. In describing the strange mist that appears over the deathbed, Moody says, quote, "They describe it in various ways. Some say that it looks like smoke, while others say it is as subtle as steam. Sometimes it seems to have a human shape. Whatever the case, it usually drifts upward and always disappears fairly quickly." Unquote. Moody's book is full of accounts of deathbed experiences and things that people have seen when their loved ones were dying. One man, named Tom, described watching the death of his mother. "I saw this film, or transparent envelope of light, close up and lift off her body, going upwards and out of sight." Moody quotes a medical doctor who told him, "I have seen mist coming up from deceased patients twice in a 6-month period. The mist had depth and complex structure. It seemed to have layers with energetic motion in it," which is a poor description, I know, but just think of something as subtle as water moving within water. A hospice psychologist told him, "I saw patients leave their bodies in a cloud form. I saw them rise out of their bodies and head towards these structures. I would describe these clouds as a sort of mist that forms around the head or chest. There seems to be some kind of electricity in it, like an electrical disturbance." In a 1975 book entitled Beyond Life's Curtain, Dr. Bernard Laubscher repeats descriptions given by carers sitting beside dying persons in care homes. "While watching at the bedside of the dying one, with one or two candles burning, they had seen the formation of a faint, vaporous body, an elongated, whitish, purplish-like cloud, parallel with the dying person, and about 2 feet above the body. Gradually, this cloud-like appearance became denser and took on the form, first vaguely, and then more definitely, of the person in the bed. This process continued until the phantom suspended above the body was an absolute replica of the person, especially the face. They noticed that there was a light all around the outline, which I could only compare to a neon tube." The neuropsychiatrist Dr. Peter Fenwick and his wife Elizabeth Fenwick, in their 2008 book, The Art of Dying, speak of the smoke, gray mist, or white mist that leaves the body at death. An informant named Penny Bycliffe told them about what she witnessed when her sister died. "I saw a fast-moving will-o'-the-wisp appear to leave her body by the side of her mouth on the right. The shock and beauty of it made me gasp. It appeared like a fluid or a gaseous diamond, pristine, sparkly, and pure, akin to the view from above of an eddy in the clearest pool you can imagine. It moved rapidly upwards and was gone. Another woman described the death of her husband. I turned my head to see if Keith was awake, and as I looked, I saw a shimmery haze, similar to what you might see above a road on a hot summer day, hover above Keith's sleeping head, and then it gradually rose up to the ceiling and vanished. A physician named Dr. R.B. Hout, that's H-O-U-T, was present at the death of his aunt and witnessed the following. My attention was called to something immediately above the physical body, suspended in the atmosphere about 2 feet above the bed. At first, I could distinguish nothing more than a vague outline of a hazy, fog-like substance. There seemed to be only a mist suspended, motionless. But as I looked, very gradually, there grew into my sight a denser, more solid condensation of this inexplicable vapor. Then I was astonished to see definite outlines presenting themselves, and soon I saw this fog-like substance was assuming a human form. The features of the face were very similar to the physical face, except that a glow of peace and vigor was expressed instead of age and pain. The eyes were closed as though in tranquil sleep, and a luminosity appeared to radiate from the spirit body. There was a silver-like substance streaming from the head of the physical body to the head of the spirit body. The color was a translucent, luminous silver radiance. The cords seemed alive with vibrant energy. I could see the pulsations of light stream along the course of it, from the direction of the physical body to the spirit double. With each pulsation, the spirit body became more alive and denser, whereas the physical body became quieter and more nearly lifeless. Hout said that when the pulsation stopped, various strands of the cord snapped. When the last connecting strand snapped, the body rose to a vertical position, the eyes opened, and a smile broke forth from the face before it vanished from my sight. A report published on the day of my own birth, January 25, 1945, quoted an American soldier back from the Second World War as saying, quote, I have seen ectoplasm on the battlefield. I have watched it emanate from a badly wounded soldier and then disappear as that soldier breathed his last. One hillbilly comrade from Kentucky called it soul mist, revealing that many natives in his part of the country considered it quite a normal thing, although they seldom talked about it. He went on to tell how, after being wounded by shrapnel, another soldier lay badly wounded about 10 feet from him. I looked at him with pity, forgetting my own pain. Then, in the deepening twilight, I saw a strange smoke begin to curl above him, as though coming from his stomach as he lay on his back, moaning. Then I remembered what my friend had said about soul mist, and I watched fascinated as the ectoplasm became denser and began to flow towards me. For a moment, I thought I saw in it the face of a kindly old lady. Presently, it reached me, and for a second, I was bewildered by a strange sensation that came over me. I felt stronger. With my left arm, I raised myself and began to crawl to the dying soldier. I reached out for my canteen of water. The mist was still around me, and with a sudden effort, I was on my feet and beside the soldier. To my dying day, I shall believe the ectoplasm from the body of that dying soldier had helped me in a mysterious way. It had given me sufficient strength to save my life. And there is not only a death flash, there is also a death signal before that. This bizarre finding has so far only been verified at a very small scale. but it is believed to occur in the body as a whole. One of the earlier articles reporting this phenomenon, known as programmed cell death, was written by Michael Ottmar Hengartner when he was working at Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory in New York. He is now president of the University of Zurich. He reported that the deaths of cells, cell deaths, seem to occur as a result of what he called a suicide program. Further study of this strange phenomenon has been primarily done at Stanford University by Professor James E. Farrell, Jr., and Shenru Cheng, who is a postdoc colleague of the older Farrell, who works at the Stanford Cancer Research Laboratory in the School of Medicine. Farrell and Cheng's discoveries were first announced in a press release by Hanai Arbitage of Stanford on 9th of August 2018, followed the next day by the publication of a key paper by Farrell and Cheng in Science magazine. The press release commences by describing their discoveries like this. In a cell, death is akin to falling dominoes. One death-inducing molecule activates another, and so on, until the entire cell is shut down, a new Stanford study finds. Inside a cell, death often occurs like the wave at a baseball game. What starts with two hands flung skyward prompts another and another until the wave has rippled far and wide across the whole stadium. This kind of a rolling surge, spurred by the activity of one or a few things, is known as a trigger wave. A new study out of the Stanford University School of Medicine has found that this phenomenon guides one of the most well-known and widespread forms of cell death, apoptosis. It's not the first time trigger waves have been identified in the microcosms of life. The cell cycle, a cornerstone of cell biology in which cells divide to make new cells, regulates production via trigger waves too. So do neuronal action potentials, which allow neurons to pass signals via electrical impulse. And it likely doesn't end there. One really has to congratulate Hanai Arbitage, who can write a press release worthy of a science journal in its own right. The technical word for cell death, as we have just seen, is apoptosis. Cheng and Farrell put a lot of effort into researching whether, quote, the propagation of apoptotic signals, unquote, that's signals that say die, die, die to cells, could possibly be chemical diffusion. But they were able to demonstrate that this was all happening by trigger waves, which act in a very peculiar way indeed. If the signals had been by chemical diffusion, they would have slowed down with increasing distance, but the trigger waves did not slow down, no matter how far they traveled. In fact, they progressed relentlessly at a constant speed. They do this by positive feedback in the signal transduction, which means transmission of signals to cells, which allows signals to propagate quickly over large distances without diminishing in strength or speed. We suspect there may be other examples of trigger waves in intra- and intercellular communication. The steady speeds of the death waves, studied by Cheng and Farrell, were 30 micrometers per minute. Because the waves resemble the flows of calcium ions, which had been studied to such an extent by Peter Mitchell, who was mentioned earlier, which are ionic charged currents, we can regard them as genuine plasma flows. In other words, death appears to take place by plasma signals, which are able to traverse cells without losing any strength or slowing down. The body is riddled with biocurrents, such as proton pathways, electron pathways, and ion pathways, sending signals every which way. I had intended to write a chapter about this, with emphasis on the work of Peter Mitchell, but decided it was not necessary for this book, which contains enough information as it is. One amusing little tidbit that I cannot resist mentioning, however, is what R.J.P. Williams said in Nature in 1995 about protons moving along proton pathways inside the body. Quote, protons move in very short hops, smaller than one angstrom unit, which is 1/10 of a nanometer, and require rotational movements of many donor and acceptor groups to make the process continuous, unquote. I thought the idea of hopping protons was so funny, listeners might like to have a good laugh at the thought. However, the death signals traveling at constant speed are evidently not transmitted by hopping protons, but by speedier and more reliable means. Death signals by photons had previously been detected by the Russian scientist Vlail Petrovich Koznacheyev in a series of more than 5,000 experiments carried out at his Institute of Clinical and Experimental Medicine in Novosibirsk in Siberia. In 1976, an English translation of one of his papers appeared discussing the apparent paranormal transmission of death between cells. It is not only death that has flashes and signals, it is conception as well. When a human egg is fertilized by a sperm, a light flash is seen. This has been filmed, and many people will have seen the various films of this on YouTube. Although the conception flash is ultra-weak, in the same way that biophoton emissions are, these flashes, too, are caused by a wave of calcium ions going through the cell. And calcium ion flow is a form of plasma, just as we have seen in the death waves. It seems that 20% of the egg's zinc is jettisoned upon successful fertilization. Anyone who is interested in this subject should watch the very dramatic moving films of the flashes. Death flashes may not have been filmed yet, but conception flashes most definitely have been. What does all of this mean? We have flashes and signals to do with when physical life begins and when physical life ends. It appears that these are points when our plasma cells activate and deactivate our physical bodies. But what remains constant must be our bioplasma cells. Bioplasma bodies do not wear out through physical wear and tear. It is the physical bodies that do that. Whether bioplasma bodies have other and non-physical ways of undergoing any kind of disintegration, we do not know. But as it could not be physical, it is likely that it would take the form of an impairment or degrading, rather than a total catastrophic collapse. In recent times, the development of new technology has given us vantage points from which to see ourselves and our own intelligence in a new light. AI, artificial intelligence, tends to see intelligence in terms of the transmission and processing of information. When it comes to understanding and defining human intelligence, this perspective leads naturally to a focus on the flow of information, rather than in the traditional way, which focused on the flow of chemical and biological processes. This school of thought is sometimes called information theory, and we will see what great insights it inspires in the next and final chapter. Traditional digital computers work by considering simple either-or options, and sometimes in the case of very powerful digital computers, an immense accumulation of them. The bigger the accumulation, the more powerful the computer. The quantum computers, currently in development, on the other hand, work on a wholly different level, because they are able to consider many more options than a simple either-or at any one time, and make multiple calculations simultaneously. And in this they are, of course, very like the human mind. We are able to consider many options at once, which is perhaps why we have free will, in a way that digital computers do not. Crucial to the development of how these quantum computers work is the way they use plasma. Another instance of plasma acting as a gateway for effects to emerge into the macro world. Are we now able, from the vantage point created by the development of machine intelligence and quantum computers, to look at our own evolution, and particularly the evolution of our intelligence, in the light of plasma? In the next chapter, we will expand our understanding of how universal fields not only influence our consciousness, but also help to create it. We will also address the issue of consciousness in the universe as a whole. Chapter